Welcome to the Edge Conservation Podcast, where we bring you the latest in innovation, insight, and effort on the front lines of wildlife conservation in Africa and around the world. I'm your host, Kira Dorian. Today, we're taking you to the Waterberg region of Limpopo, South Africa, to speak with Jessica Babich, who's the executive director of Save the Waterberg Rhino, whose mission is to create an ark for rhinos, other wildlife, and communities in Waterberg. Jessica, thank you so much for joining us today. I am so excited to get to speak with you.
Well, the pleasure is mine. I'm delighted to be invited to talk on your show, and it's wonderful to be able to share our message with you and your audience.
Excellent. So can we just start by having you tell us a little bit about Save the Waterberg Rhino? Like, just give us some ideas about what you're doing, how it got started, how you're involved, all those juicy pieces of information.
Wow. Okay. That's quite a chunk of info. Well, to cut a long story short, I'm sure you and your listeners are very well aware that there was a rhino war fought before in the 70s and 80s. And everything seemed to be relatively stable until about 2008, when there was an upsurge or an upswing in rhino poaching. And this started to affect us in South Africa as a nation, and then the Waterberg region in particular started to become affected as well. And in 2011, there was a particular rhino poaching incident where a mother and her calf were both brutally murdered on a particular farm. The following year, literally it was a month or two after that, there was another female white rhino that was poached, but her little baby, her calf, managed to escape the poachers. So the roots of Save the Waterberg Rhino stemmed from these rhino poaching incidents. The owners of the reserve and lodges where the rhinos are housed are Ant and Tess Baber. They are amazing people who run two amazing lodges. And when their rhinos were poached, this caused them to become very active with regards to establishing the roots of Save the Waterberg Rhino. So this organization really began in 2012. Following a tragedy, but also linked to a triumph of survival, because the little white rhino calf that survived, his name is Max. He has become an ambassador for our organization. He survived. He ran away from the poachers. He wandered with a herd of wildebeest for some time after the poaching incident. And a miracle happened, because another female rhino, her name is Sophie, she had a young calf that was about the same age as Max, and she came across Max the one day, and she basically took him under her wing. The team at the lodges were absolutely astounded, and she took him under her wing. Fortunately, Max was old enough to be able to eat a bit of grass, but he was obviously missing his mother's milk, and although Sophie, the adopting mother, didn't allow him to feed, being with other rhinos was exactly what he needed. So he is the emblem. He is the survivor. He is the representative of the change that began in 2012 for our organization, the roots of Save the Waterberg Rhino.
Wow, that is an amazing story.
Indeed. And visitors who come to see us in the Waterberg, especially those that are guests at those particular lodges, actually have the opportunity to go and see Max and to be in his presence and to feel this remarkable energy from this incredible animal and his family. So what happened following the foundation of this organization was that the aims and objectives with regards to what we had to do were very clear. We had to protect the Waterberg rhino population. Not many people are aware that this is actually the third largest rhino population in South Africa in this region. In fact, if current stats are accurate, we have more black rhino in this area than they do left in Kenya, because the struggle to protect rhino populations is exponential. It's an ever-increasing risk, cost, and responsibility. So when the organization was founded, we do one thing, and we raise funds. The funds that we raise go into three primary portfolios. The first is security, support, and enhancement for the region. That in and of itself is a more complex a portfolio that I'm happy to discuss with you during the interview. The second portfolio that we raise funds for is environmental awareness. You cannot expect an individual who lives in a township or in a place such as South Africa where there's great socio-political and great socio-economic divide to care about a rhino. You cannot expect that. It's not reasonable. They have far greater challenges on their plate. However, the fact that this rhino poaching exists means that there is crime. And crime affects every single citizen of this country. Some of our rural populations are the most greatly affected. So the rhinos are actually saving us. And this is where this environmental awareness component is so important, because we've got to start spreading the message of creating rhino champions, creating conservation champions. And that's done in a variety of ways through our programs, and also with the cooperation and support and collaboration of a number of stakeholders in our region. And then the third aspect that we raise funds for is community upliftment. And that means that we do have food garden programs that are operating at quite a number of our schools. We're just recently embarking on a partnership with the Tutu Desk Foundation, which is an initiative of the Archbishop Desmond Tutu. It's a global campaign to provide portable school desks for rural children. So this is just one of the many aspects up to and including training associated with various aspects of what is required to roll out effective security anti-rhino poaching and ranger support programs. So we raise funds to be able to put the money right back into the community, right back where it is needed. And so in a nutshell, that's where the origins of this organization came from. And that is our purpose, our vision, to raise funding so that we can continue to support, secure, and strengthen the Waterberg area. Because at the current rate of rhino poaching, we have to create some kind of an arc to preserve species diversity, genetic diversity, and just a safe haven for people and communities. We need to set an example about how this can be done.
So you said that the rhinos save us. And I guess I'm still a little confused about what that means. I understand that the idea that where there's crime, it's creating, you know, discourse in the community. Is that what you mean? That, like, by protecting these rhinos, we can reduce the crime and that's going to actually protect the people in the community?
That is correct. Because what not very many people are aware of, but it's actually quite a straightforward yet complex equation. And this is as follows. Rhino poaching is part of a greater global crime issue. So the issue of crime that we're talking about when it comes to rhino poaching affects each and every individual. So a rhino will affect you guys in the States, it'll affect somebody in Europe in the most unexpected ways. And the reason why is as follows. I'm sure many of your passionate listeners already are aware that rhino poaching is linked to one of four black market crimes globally that affects each citizen on this planet. The first and the largest of these black market crime activities is arms and munitions. That's the black market weapons trade. That's everything from tanks and grenade launchers and missile launchers through to handguns and ammunition. So that's the biggest trade that affects us all globally. The second is drugs. Drugs are something every single nation on this earth has been affected by and continues to be affected by. So drugs is very much hand in hand with these four black market crimes that affect us all. The third is human trafficking. Slavery is not dead. There is still an astonishing amount of slavery that takes place. There's a lot of sex slave trafficking in children and in women. There's various hotspots around the world. So that's the third black market crime that affects us all. And then the fourth is wildlife trafficking. So by wildlife, I'm meaning everything from the largest of mammals, such as elephants, because of course ivory and so forth is an issue, as well as rhino poaching and for their horn, through to pangolins, through to the tiniest of plant species and reptile species that generally tend to go unnoticed. So when we are taking our message out to our local and global communities, the first thing that we do is draw the attention to the fact that these four black market crimes exist. Because guaranteed, the audience that is in front of you or listening has been affected by one of these in some way, because everyone understands and agrees that if you find, for example, rhino poaching, that automatically invites the biggest of the four black market crimes into the equation, which is arms and munitions. Now we've got people walking through and coming through our area with weapons.
Can I interrupt you for a second? So I guess I'm still not clear on where's that link? So I understand if you've got poaching, you've got you've got this particular part of the black market in your region, but how does that then invite these other three?
Okay, super. So good question. One example would be, I'm not sure to what degree in the States you are aware of the issue of farm attacks in South Africa or certain levels of violent crime in particular areas. So for example, and this is just a broader case scenario, if you have a group of criminals that are intent on finding weapons, they're not going to try and do so legally. They're going to do so in the form of usually a violent crime. In very rural farming districts like this, this means that they could potentially target a landowner that they know has weapons on the property. This means that they would then commit the crime of breaking and entering, robbery, worst case, murder, rape. You know, these things happen, and they would then take the weapons from the house that then would be used in other crimes. So these weapons are unregistered. Crime is mobile. They can be used to move from one province or one area of the country to the other. So the weapons that are stolen could potentially be not only with the sole purpose of poaching a rhino, but to inflict other crimes on members of our society.
Got it. Okay, thank you. That's really helpful to clarify that.
Whenever I'm talking to people about this rhino poaching issue, and I say the rhinos are saving us, they look at me in puzzlement because it's not an equation that we are used to hearing. But since we embarked on this quest and this vision and this mission and this aim to lock down this Waterberg area and look after its rhinos, look after its people, through exploring this issue of rhino poaching, so we as an organization have become exposed to just how interlinked with other crimes it is. If you get the guys coming in with weapons, 100% I know that they come in with drugs as well. So you start to get this infiltration that then affects society. Drugs are an incredibly degrading element for so many reasons, and that in itself leads to other associated crimes. So when we understood just how intrinsically the rhino poaching crisis is linked to this overall global crime problem, we could then understand how it is linked to and is affected by our local circumstance and how it influences local crime. The minute that somebody in a rural environment understands the fact, because we're all affected by crime, the minute that they see the rhinos being a potential link to start changing that situation, so we begin to embark on the journey of change of mind, change of heart, awakening of understanding, and empowerment of the people that they're a part of the solution, that the good people outnumber the bad people, that we have systems that we can plug in together to strengthen our collective work to create a crime-free zone. And it's the rhino poaching crisis that started this whole journey. So that's why the rhinos are actually saving us.
Wow, that's incredible. So what kind of protection do they have right now? Because my understanding is they're on the majority privately owned. Is that correct?
Yes. Here in the Waterberg, we have approximately 80% of the rhinos that are privately owned. Now, the problem with this is that there are many private rhino owners that have disinvested in the species. This effectively means that they can no longer afford to pay for and maintain the ever-increasing costs and aspects relating to security to protect their rhinos. This means that you've got armed men coming onto your property, potentially targeting you, targeting your staff, targeting your tourists, if that's the case, worst case scenario. Not that that has happened, but it's a risk. So here in the Waterberg, one of the reasons why this organization was started is because private rhino owners don't receive a heck of a lot of support. This is not to say that there's not support available, but when one acts in isolation, it limits the potential of efficacy. It limits the potential of support. It limits the potential of success. And success to us means prevention, prevention of crime. Prevention is better than cure. So that's the premise. So we want to be proactive as opposed to reactive. So it's taken us over the years, and we continue to do so, cultivate relationships with individuals, groups, organizations, businesses, as well as various government departments in order to achieve the goal of locking down the Waterberg, bring in funding, bring in support to the various programs, because there's no one silver bullet. There's not a silver bullet solution to this. We have to act in a multiple application of thoughts, ideas, synergies, and collaborations. And that's why what we are doing here is really starting to bear fruit, because we've got so many people collaborating with and supporting us from both local right the way through to international level as well.
Wow. And so what do you think you need next? Like, what are the next steps for your organization?
You know, how long is a piece of string? I mean, okay, here's the problem. Part of the problem that we face is poaching is a low risk, high gain enterprise. There is, if you really stop to think about it, and if we're truly honest with ourselves, getting access to people who are prepared to poach is almost unlimited. Because here in Africa, particularly sub-Saharan Africa, which is where our regional issues stem from, we have a lot of socioeconomic difficulties. One of the added factors that we have in not only South Africa, but many countries around the world, is that of corruption, which means that if your law enforcement and your law practitioners and your legal sort of structures are not firm and clear when it comes to law enforcement to help prevent rhino poaching, clamp down on the traffickers, etc., then you're already at a disadvantage. So one of the problems that I mentioned earlier is disinvestment. Where are the rhinos going that the owners can no longer afford to keep? So this is an ever-increasing issue. And that's why we in the Waterberg are working collaboratively with as many people as possible to create that arc. This requires many, many layers of various applied practices and technologies to make it happen. So what do we need next? It's never ending. The need is constant. There's always something. For all three of our portfolios, we're always looking for funding support. One of the examples I'd like to give you is that there is an increasing market in technologies that are specifically geared towards wildlife conservation and wildlife protection. There's some phenomenal stuff going on out there. So in the Waterberg, think of it like layers of an onion. We have an outer layer, a periphery of technologies, various integrated technologies that are there to help act as an early warning system. These technologies are themselves integrated with other technologies and analytical softwares and national programs that are designed for crime prevention. So think of that as the outer layer. And then just like an onion, we've got layer upon layer upon layer. Within the 2 million hectares that we are concentrating on locking down, we have clusters. Each cluster is a certain amount in size. They manage their own affairs, but they are part of the collective. And we make sure that everyone is talking and collaborating. But we need to raise funds to help the people implement the things that they need. So that could be as simple as, for example, we've been suffering incredible heat here at the moment. We have to take a moment to feel for the rangers and all of the foot patrols that are out there in that blistering heat, walking through incredibly rugged terrain. The Waterberg is beautiful, but my gosh, there are some tough areas out there, and these men are doing it on their feet all the time in the heat. They are amazing. And one of the simplest of requests has just come from our national park, that they need extra hydration packs, you know, those water bladders. That's something we can help with. That's something we've raised funds for, and we've got people that can help. But one of the things we're looking for is this area is very rural. It is very rugged. It is very vast. We need to raise funds for people like our endangered species unit. I cannot tell you how distressing it is for me to receive a call from one of our unit members who is out in an area. They are trying to track poachers that they've just prevented a poaching, but he has not got the technology. He hasn't got the technology to be able to have ground-to-air communications with the helicopters. He doesn't have enough radios to give to the ground patrol so he can coordinate the movements properly. And yet they still succeed, but they shouldn't have to struggle so. So communications and investment in communications technology is very important. So from boots on the ground right through to overarching technology systems, we constantly are exploring, raising funds for, and implementing what we need now and what we need today to keep the ark safe, to keep our people safe, to keep every species safe. That's from the tiniest grain of sand to every drop of water in the river. We must work together. And I have to say, we've got an incredible community, and it's coming together beautifully. We want people to be able to know that they can have a safe haven for these animals so that the war can be fought. We will fight this battle here. Other people can fight their battles, but together we must come together to fight the war. Otherwise, we're going to be losing some iconic species, and I certainly, amongst all my other counterparts and peers, are not prepared to let that happen.
So let me ask you a couple questions about the Waterberg region itself, because UNESCO's determined it to be a special region. I know it's a biosphere. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, I can. The Waterberg is so special. I mean, don't even get me started. One of the advantages that I have is I have a board and a team who are very supportive of collaboration. In that regard, I also fulfill other roles within the Waterberg region. I'm part of the committee for the Waterberg Biosphere Reserve itself. I am vice chair of the Waterberg Nature Conservancy, and I'm also the secretary of our local community policing forum. So the Waterberg, as a UNESCO biosphere, was proclaimed as such. It is a stunning region. It's mostly a lot of wilderness. It's beautiful, rugged bushveld, mountains, and the most incredible landscapes. And as I mentioned, it's approximately 2 million hectares in size. That's the plateau of the Waterberg. The UNESCO heritage status has been in place for some time, and this area not only boasts the rhino populations, but a host of other incredible species of plants and wildlife. Some are endemic to the region. They are found nowhere else. And research on various levels is discovering that the ecosystems that exist here in the Waterberg are unique to this area, and that's still something that's being explored. So from a biosphere perspective, this region is extremely fortunate. We have no major mining activities within the heart or within the main body of the Waterberg. Those all take place on the periphery. We have a very small human population with regards to the size. And it is just the most remarkable region to come and be a tourist. Obviously, we've got our big five game areas, but some real highlights. And this is, again, this is just me personally. I love wild dogs. And this area, the Waterberg, has South Africa's last true free-roaming wild dog pack in the area. It's a remarkable thing. The dogs have just had 9 puppies. There's a whole local chat group. We follow the dogs that they've got collars on. And as a matter of fact, as I speak to you guys now, while you're in the States and I'm here under the African moon, the wild dogs are just a kilometer or two away from me. We've heard them calling on the farm where we live a couple of times. So it's just the most wonderful region. It's the most incredible wilderness area with beautiful, beautiful fauna and flora, stunning communities, and a very rich cultural heritage. As a matter of fact, there is the most phenomenal institution that's due to open this December. It's called the Living Museum. It has been founded and established by the Walker family. And this museum is the most incredible facility. It has everything from rhino museum and elephant museums and cultural and social artifacts through to medicinal plant gardens. And this is going to be one of the hubs where the environmental education for the region takes place.
Wow.
So we support the museum. Wow. There are going to be thousands of children that come through there to experience and learn things in ways that they've never had the opportunity to do. It's just going to be absolutely phenomenal. And all of this started because of the rhinos and the war. So, you know, out of a darkness comes a light. And that's basically what we are trying to do, is shine a light, make it brighter, make it stronger. Let the people come towards the light. Let's make it brighter still. And then we change the world. Then we cultivate those rhino and conservation champions.
I love that. And of course, when you're educating children, you're then raising up a whole generation that views this crisis differently. Mm. You know, so many people of even my generation still have to be educated, still have to even know that it exists.
Yes.
And be informed. If
yes.
you're raising those children up, then they grow up already with that information and already with a mindset of wanting to facilitate that change and be that change.
Exactly. I don't know, Kira, if you've ever had the opportunity of being around a live rhino at close proximity. It is a soul experience. You experience it with many, many species of wildlife. You know that special moment when you've got pets at home. You look at your dog or your cat in that special way and there's like a soul connection. And it's the same with these animals. We're trying to be a voice for the voiceless. It's a magical experience, and that's why we as Save the Waterberg Rhino, we work with partners. We work with the Waterberg Biosphere Reserve. We work with La Palala Wilderness School, a phenomenal institution. We work with La Palala Wilderness Reserve. We work with Valgevonden Reserve and Shambhala, our local national park, Marikele, Maritaba, which is in conjunction with the national park, and many, 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 many others, including Tusk. That's, of course, the UK-based charity. So it's endless, this networking that we do to unify and to create a web of harmony where we can get things done and achieve the goals that we've set out to do. And like I say, that's again why the rhinos are saving us. This all started because the species suddenly was being persecuted. There was a sudden upsurge. It was shocking. It was emotional. And that's where institutes like the museum and some of the programs that we do as Save the Waterberg Rhino. Kira, do you know what I'm talking about when I mentioned your soul switch?
Mm-mm.
Okay, so a soul switch, when I talk about a soul switch, it's that thing, it's that moment, that defining moment when something inside you clicks. And that element of love or passion or wonderment or connection takes place in that moment. And one of those things is with the rhino. So again, if we have a child living in one of our local townships, this poor little thing probably doesn't have a heck of a lot of resources. In fact, I do a lot of community work in the schools and they don't have a lot of resources. So let's for one moment imagine what it must be like for a child to sit at a desk with somebody standing in front of them to say, protect the rhinos. It's meaningless. But the minute that we engage with them, the minute that we with partners like the Valgevonden Environmental Awareness Program or La Palala Wilderness School, suddenly these children, or like I say, the Living Museum, they will come to this place and this space and they will suddenly see a cast of the skull of a woolly rhinoceros. I mean, that's like magical. And they will go to a heritage part of the museum where they will see their cultural roots. And the history of this area, is that maybe the soul switch for them? Is the soul switch for that child going to be walking through a demonstration about why we shouldn't litter and why a clean planet is so important? Is that the soul switch? There are so many things that if we expose our children to, if we get them passionate about, it's not just looking at a picture in a book, it's not just listening to somebody standing in front of them. It's actually changed from a passive to an active learning experience. That's the key. What was it in your life? What was your route that triggered a passion in something for conservation, for radio? What was your thing? Each one of us has got the potential to have that soul switched on. But unless we're exposed to the opportunities, you're never going to know your potential and you're never going to be able to then embark upon a journey that could be just the most magical journey of your life. And that might have been happening because of one rhino. You know what I mean?
I do, actually. It's funny because so my father is South African. He grew up in Joburg. And so when I graduated from college, we went to Joburg and Cape Town and all over. And I got to meet some family I hadn't met before. And we went on a really amazing proper safari.
Yes.
And we did night rides. And I mean, it was phenomenal. I actually have this incredible photo that I took. I leaned out of the car.
Yes.
And shot this picture of a rhino. And so I know exactly what you're talking about because
yes.
It was that whole experience was it was so eye-opening, and I think you've absolutely nailed it, that seeing a picture of an animal in a book and hearing that there's, hey, some trouble there is not the same as being in their environment.
Yes.
You know, recognizing that there's a whole other world that exists outside of our human Western existence.
Yes.
That's this, I think, the soul switch you're talking about. So, yeah, I really do understand. I really have been there.
Yes, and I think from, you see, you've had your experience now that you've shared with me, and this is where I feel deeply connected with the process. You see, I feel that, especially in modern times, there was a time when human beings existed on this planet where everything that was done on a day-to-day basis was done in conjunction with the Earth. From the movement of the sun, the phases of the moon, the seasons, everything was intrinsically linked with us as beings on this planet. And that has changed significantly in modern times. Very much we're becoming increasingly detached from the realities of life, the realities of nature. And by that, I mean so many people. Look how many millions of people live on the planet today. When was the last time that you looked up on the moon and went, wow? When was the last time that you took just that moment, even if it was you driving home in rush hour traffic, to look at the sunset and go, that's amazing. That's beautiful. Just the simple process of engagement with our natural world is actually food for the soul. It's actually part of what makes us human. And so by embarking on this journey, particularly for us here in the Waterberg, we have a quest. We have a quest to re-engage with as many people and as many children as possible going forward. Support those that are on the quest with us. Provide support and opportunities for those that are wanting to embark on the quest with us. And that is how we grow. That is how we change the world. And certainly, from my perspective, I feel we must leave the world a better place when we exited from the moment that we entered it. We must leave a legacy. So it's exactly what you're saying. For the young children that have never had exposure to this beautiful connection that you can have with learning, with our world, with particular species, piranha, like the museum, enable that to happen. Visits to reserves that are supporting environmental education. Suddenly the children go into a reserve, they see what a beautiful, clean environment should look like. They take it home with them, and children are the greatest ambassadors of change. It's funny how in the natural world, especially here in Africa, elephants are the largest architects of environmental change. And yet, from a human level, the children are the greatest architects of environmental change, provided that we provide them with the necessary resources, support, and motivation to go forward. And this is part of the message that we spread, is to change that mindset. And that's part of the quest that we are on. So that the children walk out of their door and they look at a future. They look at a future of healthy living. They look at a future of thriving wildlife populations. And that in turn means a thriving tourism establishment happening here in the Waterberg. That tourism is wonderful. It's huge. This must continue into the future. I mean, tourism has been proven to support and create more jobs than an enterprise such as mining, which is obviously very harmful for the environment. So these are the kind of things we want to cultivate. We've got the opportunity here in the Waterberg. We're taking that opportunity. It's working, but the area is vast. We have many children to reach. We have many people that we need to reach. And so that's why we need to raise those funds, you know. And we raise funds for ourselves as well. We don't sit back on our laurels. You know, if I work full-time for the organization, as does each and every one of my team members. And, you know, we have to work very hard to earn our penny. But the quest is what makes it all worthwhile. To change the lives, to protect the heritage, to look after the wildlife, and most importantly, to protect the communities. This is their world. This is their Waterberg. We all live here. And this is what we are working on. And the rhino is the ambassador for that change.
So let me ask you, if our listeners want to get involved, where can they go? Give us your website, your handles on social media. Like, how can they get involved with Save the Rhino?
Wow. That is a great question. First and foremost, anybody who wants to get involved with us, the best way, we do have a website, which is waterbergrhino.com. Our website is due to be revamped in 2019, but all the essential information you need to find is on there. In addition, they can contact me via email on waterbergrhinosecretary@gmail.com. And anytime at all, I'm available to ask, to answer any questions that may be asked of us. And if there is any particular interest in one of our specific portfolios or fundraising endeavors, they can just drop me a line with the greatest of pleasure. Always available. And yes, help us on our quest. It would be wonderful to meet like-minded people together. We can really unite and make a difference. And we're making a difference here in the Waterberg.
And do you have social media handles?
Oh my gosh, thank you so much for asking. I think it's hashtag Save the Waterberg Rhino. We also have a Facebook page. I think it's Save the Waterberg Rhino on Facebook as well, and people are very welcome to follow us. In fact, for World Rhino Day this year, along with some other amazing teams and collaborators, we had an anti-rhino poaching demonstration for some of our local schools and school children. And we posted the video up there, which received an incredible response, because I think it brought home the reality to these young minds, what is really involved behind the scenes to protect a rhino. So as thrilling and as entertaining as it was a very good way of bringing home that message. So that's where you can find that particular video, is on our Facebook page.
So I understand that you have a degree in anthropology, and I am very curious about two things. First and foremost, I would love to know, was this always the plan? Like, was wildlife conservation always the plan when you got this degree in anthropology? And secondly, and more importantly, is there a different perspective with an anthropology degree? Like, is there an anthropological perspective that maybe other conservationists might not even be aware of, just based on having that specific education?
Wow, that's a really good question. Okay, just to put you in the picture, my family, all of our friends have always been involved in conservation in some way or form. Both my parents, my grandparents, my uncles, my aunts, my sister, my brother, everybody, we've all been involved in conservation in some way, shape or form. Even as a very young person, I was a volunteer at the Johannesburg Zoo because I craved wildlife. I'm very much a nature person. I was also blessed to grow up with a family that were totally into conservation. I mean, we dig ponds in the garden, put up bird boxes, and just basically create as much of an indigenous haven for any city wildlife that we could. So wildlife has always been part of the fabric of my being. And I studied travel and tourism when I left school, worked for a while in that and various personal assistant roles before I went, and I lived in London for 4 years. And that was wonderful. I managed to travel the world and experience all sorts of things, but Africa is very, very deep in my soul, and I was very homesick. So I couldn't wait to come home. And it was during my London travels, I'd always wanted to study but really didn't know what. I had tried unsuccessfully to enter into wildlife conservation when I was younger. And at that time, it wasn't as progressive as it is now. In other words, as a woman, it wasn't really acceptable for you to become a ranger, because that involved quite a bit of physical work, from fence repairs to engine repairs and so on and so forth. And I think roles for women in conservation have evolved considerably since then. So for me, my opportunity came when I'd saved up enough money to put myself through varsity, and I'd already looked around, and anthropology just resonated with me. It resonated with me because it's a social science. It's all about people, because let's remember, the rhino poaching crisis starts and ends with people, and so does the solution to the crisis. So it's all about people. So when I went to study my anthropology degree, I connected with it hugely. It resonated with me because anthropology teaches people, or anthropologists, and it certainly taught me how to engage with people in a holistic way. In other words, just because something doesn't make sense to me today doesn't mean it doesn't have any relevance in another person's world. And by taking the time to talk with and understand and integrate with different people and cultures, so our understanding of each other and the processes that drive us becomes clearer. And this increased understanding then leads to us making better decisions. So from an anthropological point of view, I've always personally been fascinated in environmental anthropology, that link between man and nature. For after all, we wouldn't exist if it wasn't for our natural world. And over the decades and the centuries, man and mankind has evolved to incredible heights, but the dynamics which drive us are taking us further away from where the attention needs to be, caring for our natural world, making sure that we act as custodians of what we do and how we do it. So from an anthropological point of view, training that I received to become that aspect of a social scientist helped hugely. It has been the foundations of my increasing levels of understanding with regards to circumstances of people and what drives them. This leads to empathy, which leads to understanding. And so the cycle is driven. And so my role at this organization, I love my job in the sense that whilst I'm confronted by a lot of challenges that our team works together to overcome, I love the journey of understanding and unpacking who we are, what we do, why we do it, and ways in which we can do things differently into the future. And that doesn't mean instant change, because humans don't change easily overnight. That's not human nature. So that's why where the multiple layer application of what the work that we're doing here is all about. We start by connecting with people on that human level first. If we engage that love, the passion, and the wonderment for our natural world, then we are changing the world. That is the difference. By allowing people access to that spiritual connection that I mentioned earlier, that in turn intrigues our more scientific mind. Why does that bird have eggs that color? Why does this particular thing work like that? What is this insect? And so the questions and the wonderment and the excitement grows. So from an anthropological point of view, it's a discipline that resonates within me. It's something that has formed the basis of a lot of the projects that we at Save the Waterberg Rhino roll out. And I'm a people person. So anthropology for me was a significant step towards integrating my passions, which is wildlife and conservation and people. I like people. People are good. Mm-hmm. People can make change. And there are far, far more good people out there than there are bad.
Yes, that is true. Jessica, thank you so much for your time, your knowledge today. It's been just an absolute pleasure speaking with you.
Honestly, all the pleasure is mine. What a wonderful treat to be able to talk with you and to share the message with your listeners. Honestly, it's absolutely my pleasure. It's been wonderful.
Well, everyone, thank you so much for listening today as we interview Jessica Babich from Save the Waterberg Rhino. As always, I like to finish with a quote. Today's quote is by Paul Oxton, founder of the Wild Heart Wildlife Foundation. He says, "Only when the last of the animal horns, tusks, skin, and bones have been sold will mankind realize that money can never buy back our wildlife." And finally, he says, "No one in the world needs a rhino horn, but a rhino." Join us next week. Our podcast is produced by Eric Johnson, me, Kira Dorian, and Edge. Thanks for listening.